Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nikazi Oates, the host of the channel. With me today is Bryant Terry. He is a James Beard and NAACP Image Award-winning chef, educator, and author, renowned for his activism to create a healthy, just, and sustainable food system. Since 2015, he has been the chef in residence at the Museum of African Diaspora in San Francisco. He is the editor-in-chief of Four Colored Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House and 10 Speed Press. We'll be talking about his newest book, Black Food, Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora, which he curated and edited. Black Food was named one of the best books of the year by Time Out, Vice, and Publishers Weekly. Bryant, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Kazi. Can I just say you have one of the best radio/podcast voices I've heard all year.
Thank you so much.
I'm feeling no lies.
Appreciate it, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
So what we do on the show, we kick off the interview by having the guests talk a little bit about themselves, but I want to do it through the space that you work in. So in preparation for this interview, I read that in your lab or your workspace, you have a portrait of Edna Lewis and a poster or a flyer of the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, among the many pieces of art that decorates your workspace. So tell me the significance of this culinary icon, as well as the cultural and political icons through the Black Panther Party.
Sure. The lab is my shed that I built when my wife and I were pregnant with our second child. And it gives me workspace outside of our main house. And it's more than just workspace. It's I call it the lab because I feel like, you know, it's the most important space where I ideate and experiment and, you know, just figure out my next moves. But it's probably the space outside of nature that I go to get the most inspiration, because it does have a lot of my art collection is in there. And so it's decorated with a number of pieces that I have. But the two that you mentioned, one, the portrait of Edna Lewis by the photographer John T. Hill, who has been, you know, just such an important person in terms of how we have been able to see and connect with Miss Lewis visually, because he, you know, most pictures that you see of Edna Lewis, John T. Hill probably captured her for those images. He was a graduate chair at Yale in the photography program, but I think he's just kind of doing whatever he wants to do now. So that piece is very special to me. I have had the opportunity to get to know him and we become friends. So he gifted me that portrait of her. And I love it because she has, you know, her hair just beautifully styled naturally. And she has on, you know, some earrings that look like they're from West Africa, and she's just, you know, exuding all types of goddess energy. And then the there is an image that was inspired by a photograph of the Black Panther Party's Free Breakfast for Children program. And it's actually a line drawing by one of my big brothers and mentors, Brett Cook Disney, who's a visual artist here in the Bay Area, based in Berkeley. So yeah, those two pieces, I actually have both of those on my bookshelf. So when I'm Zooming, typically you'll see Edna Lewis and the Black Panthers behind me, but I'll start with the Black Panther Party for self-defense. And I feel like it's always important for me to use their full name that, you know, they used when they were founded. You know, I know we colloquially we call them the Black Panthers, but they were the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Why? Because in the mid to late 60s, they were addressing the same issues that we're addressing now: police violence, police coming into our communities and violating the rights of citizens, you know, people who should have their rights protected. And as we've seen all too often, you know, not just violence, but sometimes actual murdering citizens. So I always think it's important to recognize that that's, you know, addressing police violence was an impetus for the Black Panthers to, you know, be created. That was the kind of like, the energy that was happening in Oakland. They were policing the police. And so, you know, I would say in terms of the inspiration for me to commit a large part of my adult life to being a food justice activist, someone who is working towards creating a more healthful and just and sustainable food system. Largely, my entree into this work was because of the work that the Black Panthers did in the late 60s and the 70s. And when I was a graduate student at NYU, I learned more about their survival programs. I had known about the Black Panthers, obviously, and knew that they were more than the kind of negative portrayal by the mainstream media of them just being kind of the gun-toting, you know, just loud-talking militants. I knew that was just in line with the way in which, you know, many of our revolutionaries are vilified and the propaganda to turn the people against them. But I didn't know the extent to which they had, you know, so many meaningful programs that were addressed at, you know, meeting the basic needs of people living in communities. And they had over 60 of them under the rubric of their survival programs. And the ones that moved me the most were the ones that I think so brilliantly addressed this intersection of poverty, malnutrition, and institutional racism. You know, they had grocery giveaways in which they were giving away bags of food to low-income residents of the Bay Area. And then they had their Free Breakfast for Children program that they founded, which was aimed at feeding children a hot, nourishing breakfast every morning. And so, you know, learning about that work, the programmatic response to issues of poverty and malnutrition and racism in our communities. But, you know, being very clear that the issues that they were addressing then, we were still, you know, dealing with them. We weren't out of the woods, you know. And I always talk about this moment because it was such a powerful moment for me to see the world through a different lens after learning more about their work. And, you know, really experientially kind of understanding that young people were being stuffed and starved. You know, I was on the subway, I was going to TA one morning, and it's like 7:30 in the morning, and I see these young people across the train on my way to Manhattan from Brooklyn, and they were on the way to school, presumably eating candy bars and Red Hot Cheetos and drinking energy drink, you know, the energy beverages and sugary juices and sodas. And I was just very clear that, you know, there needed to be a shift. And I knew it wasn't about them. I knew, you know, I was very clear, we can't blame the victim, because, you know, it was clear that structurally, one, these were the type of foods that were available in the communities and that they were aggressively being marketed to consume. And, you know, two, there's just like that kind of understanding of these structural realities. And so it, that moment and that period of research led me into food justice activism. And I, you know, started my journey from there. But, you know, Edna Lewis came a little bit later because I didn't really know about Edna Lewis until I became, until I was in culinary school. And I think I was one of two Black people in my class in culinary school. I went to the Natural Gourmet Institute in Manhattan. It was based in Manhattan, but now they've been absorbed by the Institute of Culinary Education. But it's the first health supportive culinary school in the country. And so the focus was really on, you know, looking at these different eating models from macrobiotics to vegetarianism to veganism to, you know, raw food diet, and just thinking about food as medicine and how, you know, as chefs, we could really play the a role of being healers. And I went in very clear that I don't want to work in a restaurant. You know, I didn't want to be a caterer or anything like that. I went in with a very clear goal of gaining the skills to, you know, found this organization, Be Healthy, that use cooking as a way to engage and excite young people and move them towards, you know, being politicized around food issues so that they could be the ones who are kind of leading the change in their communities. So, you know, in cooking school, I'm always thinking about mentors, whether, you know, in real life or mentored by the words of people who've come before us. And so I started researching because I felt like there was very little mention of Black chefs. So much of the, you know, it was a bit different than your traditional kind of culinary school where it's largely centered around like French and Italian cooking techniques. Actually, Asian cooking techniques inspired a lot of the curriculum, you know, coming out of kind of macrobiotics being so ascendant in the 1970s when the school was founded. But I still wanted to find Black chefs that I could look up to and who would inspire me to continue to hone my craft. And I discovered Edna Lewis, and I was so just blown away by her for a couple of reasons in her story. One, she was such an eclectic and just like a brilliant, just free Black woman. You know, she just did whatever she wanted to do. You know, people know her as a chef and a cookbook writer, but I know at one point she was like, was she like the secretary of Oscar De La Renta? Or maybe she was a seamstress for that company. So she was like working in fashion. I know that she had some dealings with, you know, far left political movements in New York City. I feel like she was involved with the Communist Party. So anyway, I was just like, this is who I'm trying to model myself after, you know, in terms of just like not being limited to one way of kind of expressing brilliance in the world. So yeah, I learned about her, and I was really impressed with the fact that she disrupted this what I've seen is this very reductive way that people often imagine Black food, either as kind of antebellum survival foods or the big flavored meats and overcooked vegetables and sugary desserts that one might find at a soul food restaurant. But she talked about the diversity and the complexity and the seasonality and the just the bounty of, you know, these thriving local food systems in traditional Southern communities, you know, specifically where she came from, Freetown, Virginia. So yeah, she just had all the right, hit all the right notes in terms of like who I imagine kind of modeling at least partially my trajectory in the food space. And so I keep them behind me to just always keep me grounded in what is most important. And I started this work because of the movement building piece. I really wanted to be a part of this, what I would argue is the most important movement of the late 20th and 21st century, food justice. And, you know, I want to always be grounded in and accountable to community, regardless of if I'm doing like actual grassroots community building work or, you know, working as a publisher as I am now. I always keep an eye on the grassroots and how I can support that work.
Yeah, definitely. And to that point about food justice, you know, I think about the number of ways that we can enter into a particular social issue. I once heard that you were introduced to food by listening to hip hop. So if you could tell our listeners about the significance of food, music, and culture.
Sure. I grew up in a musical family. I always talk about my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, Edward Bryant, and he founded a group, Eddie Bryant and the Four Stars of Harmony. And they were a traveling gospel quartet in Memphis, or, you know, in the South. We're from Memphis, but they traveled throughout the South. They were the first Black gospel group to be played on Memphis radio. And so because of my grandfather, all of my parents, my mom's siblings are musical, from, you know, my mom who sings in a church choir to my Uncle Don, who is a really popular singer-songwriter in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, before he even was doing songwriting, he was, you know, he had his own career. And he recently, 2017, he put out his third secular album. His first one was like in 1968, I think. And then in 2019, he released his third secular album, and it was nominated for a Grammy for Best Traditional Blues Album. And, you know, he's just been, in terms of like, family member who has been successful, who has been an independent artist, who has been able to amass, you know, wealth in order to kind of support family and shift realities for some of our family members who weren't able to, you know, tap into formal education and things like that. I mean, he's just been an inspiration for me since I was young. So all that to say is that we just had a thriving, like, music culture in our family. We had a thriving food culture in our family because we have roots in the agrarian South. And these things were inseparable. Whenever we gathered, it was just, you know, family members. My uncle was playing piano, his brothers were crooning, my mom and her sisters were singing. You know, it was like music was always, it was like talent shows that whenever we gathered. And of course, food was always central to family gatherings as well. And, you know, part of it is about me reliving these magical moments and recognizing that so many people haven't had the opportunity to gather around the table in these ways. And you know, but the larger political project is kind of reintegrating what I see. You know, our industrialized food system is created food, like food is this commodity, and it's on one side, and all the things that have traditionally been so integrated with the way that we grow food and cook it and eat it, like music and art and culture and community, they're, you know, way over on this other side. And so I really see the work that I do as kind of bridging this chasm and bringing these things back together. So yeah, but all that to say, like, I know this is kind of a circuitous. Let me get to the point of just like the moment that I would say was the catalyst for me becoming a food justice activist was when I heard the hip hop song Beef by the seminal hip hop group Boogie Down Productions, with their lead rapper KRS-One and DJ producer Scott LaRock. Yeah. I heard that and it just changed everything for me, because like many people, I think I was convinced that, you know, animals are just kind of like running around in the field and they go to sleep and then they end up on our plate. But, you know, I had no idea about the type of violence that animals endured in our industrialized food system. And it was just one of those moments where I couldn't look back. Like once I learned about that, with KRS-One so brilliantly articulating the violence against animal and the animals and the impact that it has not only on the animals but on human health and the environment as well, I really felt like I had to change my own personal habits and attitudes in politics. But that really excited me about being active in trying to, you know, change these systems. And so it started with that song. And then my dad actually, he said he'd give me the tape, because we listened to tapes back then, of The Boogie Down Productions Edutainment was the name of the LP. So he said he'd give me the tape if I would read this book, The Jungle, and then, you know, write him a one page synopsis because he was a tiger dad. But it was a song and a book, fiction that actually kind of moved me into this work. And so I always recognize that people learn in different ways. Maybe a heady intellectual lecture might move certain people to think differently about food, but maybe it's a delicious meal. Maybe it's a song. Maybe it's a riveting piece of art. And so I'm always thinking about the multiple ways that we can kind of inspire and educate people beyond just text.
Yeah, beyond text. And to the point of inspiration, one of the questions that I ask the guests who have been on the show that I've interviewed is, I don't think we talk enough about moments of insecurity or doubt that we have had and discussed it with the public. And so I want to take this opportunity for you to reflect on, you know, this great career that you have had in trying to reimagine how we consume food, to think about a moment of self-doubt that you had, but then also couple that with a moment of reassurance or clarity or even triumph that you had during your life's work.
Sure. I'll say early on, one of the biggest moments of self-doubt was when my literary agent and I were shopping my second book, Vegan Soul Kitchen. My first book, Grub, was co-authored with my friend and colleague, Anna LaPay. And, you know, we got like an amazing book deal for first-time authors. Well, I was a first-time author. She had co-written a book with her mother, Frances Moore LaPay, who's major inspiration. She wrote the seminal text, Diet for a Small Planet, in the 1970s. And I was just very confident that, you know, coming off of getting this wildly, we got an advance that we shouldn't have gotten, but it is what it is. But it was much bigger than I think we deserved as these young authors. But, you know, I'm like confident, like, hey, I'm coming into my second book deal. It's about to be on and popping. I'm gonna get twice that amount or whatever I was thinking. And we shopped Vegan Soul Kitchen to about a dozen publishers, and 10 of them flat out said no. They were just like, no, this isn't going to work. What did they say? You're cutting the pie too thinly. You know what they were, what many of them were trying to what they were saying. You know, they said one thing, but what they meant was Black folks, like, nobody's going to buy a book about Black veganism or kind of an imagined kind of version of Black cuisine that's devoid of animal products. You know, are Black people even vegans? Like, do they even eat vegetables? That was the energy we were getting from some of these publishing houses. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, like, to be fair, there were a number of editors that were very enthusiastic and excited about the project. But I think when it came to the people who make decisions in terms of like looking at potential profits and losses, they didn't get it. And it was just one of those moments where, you know, when I kind of just ruminating on the arc of my career, and when I think about that period, I'm very clear that, you know, creatives, the people on the ground doing the work, the people out in the field, we have to trust ourselves. We have to know that our instincts, our intuition, you know, just like how we are tracking like the current kind of cultural zeitgeist, but even thinking about what the emerging zeitgeist is, like, we know it. And these big corporations, they have no idea. And, you know, so often the metrics that are used to determine who's worthy of getting a book deal is just part of the story. It doesn't tell the whole story. And I think we need to have, you know, and as a publisher, having been an author, it helps give me a better understanding of how, you know, it's not just about how many Instagram followers you have or what your social media presence is. But, you know, there are so many ways that we need to think about, like, the potential success of projects and, you know, working with creatives. But all that to say is that fast forward to 2021, we know that Black people are the fastest growing population of vegans in the United States. And, you know, I came from a community like, look, as much as we often or historically have kind of imagined veganism as the practices of these upper, you know, middle class white suburbanites, or more recently, you know, young white hipsters living in gentrified urban centers, Black people have been connected to this type of way of eating and cooking for a long time. You know, I think it's important for me to uplift the kind of thread of Black food and health, Black-led food and health activism throughout the 20th century. I mean, look, the first time I even learned about eating vegetarian or just coming into contact with the idea about veganism was from Black Seventh-day Adventists. And then, you know, after my kind of like, whatever, I feel like it was a rites of passage for a lot of people in my generation. After reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, just being like kind of obsessive about the Nation of Islam. And so, you know, during that period, learning about the health ministry that Elijah Muhammad had and, you know, his 2-volume collection, How to Eat to Live, then learning about Rastafarianism and, you know, their whole Ital diet and approach to clean eating. And so I just think it's important for me to really uplift people of African descent who've been thinking, writing, active around these type of issues. But even if you go to look at a lot of the traditional diets in West and Central Africa, or, you know, even traditional diets in the American South, I mean, they're largely vegetable based. You know, before our industrialized food system, like, working class and working poor people simply couldn't afford to have meat at every single meal. And so, you know, this idea that it's just like, we just have the worst diet in the world, the way in which our food is vilified, I just think it is wrongheaded. But all that to say, when I wasn't getting these publishers kind of enthusiastically throwing money at me, there was self-doubt. You know, I was wondering, like, what did I get myself into? What's going on? But we persisted, and we got one of the publishers, and Renee Sedliar, this editor at Hachette Books, or they saw the vision. She bought the book, and that book continues to sell. I mean, like, even that came out 2009, and I'm still getting checks from Vegan Soul Kitchen. So, you know, not to be bragging or whatever, but just to say that I had the vision, and I really want to encourage creatives to stick firmly to your vision and believe in yourself, because oftentimes, you know, these corporations or handlers who may not get the vision, they'll try to throw us off, but we just have to really double down and know that we're the experts. And, you know, maybe in that moment, we're not there, but I think it's about kind of envisioning a future that we want to see and knowing that we can kind of move towards that and manifest it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I want to turn to talking about the book, Black Food. And one of the things that you said was telling the whole story or reframing the whole story. So to that, I want to ask you, what characterizes Black food, particularly as you have it outlined or as it is portrayed in the book, or I would call it an anthology?
Sure. I think the main thing is that Black food is many things. There is no singular Black food. There is no singular Black food narrative. There are multiple narratives that are, you know, happening globally throughout history. And the main impetus for this book project was really giving people of African descent and Africans, people of African descent, the Black diaspora voice to tell our story, our stories of Black food and how we connect to these histories and cultures. You know, one of the things when I was reaching out to the more than 100 contributors or potential contributors to the book, I actually, you know, sent an email kind of connecting with folks that I thought would should be a part of it. And then I wanted to read you a quick excerpt from the email, because this really set the tone for what this book would become. And so, to be clear, also, Toni Morrison's Black book, which was, you know, it's an encyclopedic look at Black history and culture that she edited in the 70s, that book had like a major impact on me. I mean, I remember when I was an undergrad, just kind of like in the library, and it just kind of fell out and I saw it and I was just blown away. And I was really, you know, taken by the multiple ways in which she told these stories, not just with text, but with archival photos and song lyrics and ephemera and just all these, you know, different levels that, you know, when I thought about putting Black food together, I was always keeping an eye on what she did in that book. But I wrote to the different people. When I think about Black food, I keep coming back to Toni Morrison's quote, "The function of racism is distraction. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being," end quote. While this book will acknowledge the historical and contemporary ways in which our people have been marginalized, exploited, and erased, the main focus of this project is our agency, creation, and empowerment. What emerges when we aren't distracted by racism? How are we empowered? What are the ways our humanity is displayed? What are we curious about? What brings us joy? So yeah, that was how I laid it out. And I feel like, you know, people stepped up to the challenge. And I jokingly, I'm sure you know about FUBU, the label, the fashion brand started by an entrepreneur, Damon Johns. And so I told people, I was like, this is FUBU. This is for us, by us. This book is, I'm putting this together without concern for the white gaze. I want this to be something, us having a conversation with each other and inviting the world to, you know, listen in and be a part of it. So yeah, the main thing for me is, when I was thinking about the book, how can I create space for all these people throughout the Black diaspora to tell their most authentic story about their connection with Black food? And then, you know, we'll share it with the people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so funny that you mentioned Professor Toni Morrison's The Black Book, because one of the things that I think is so great and unprecedented about that book is that in many ways it was like the first like Black National Museum, right? That we would, you know, that we would get it in the form of that book that she edited, which is fantastic. And I actually own one of the first copies of the Black Book.
Wow.
Yeah. But I see a through line to Black food, because as you stated, that quote from the late Toni Morrison, Professor Toni Morrison, you know, what would happen if we remove the, you know, omnipresence of racism and the white gaze, look at the world that we have and the world that we have created. Mm-hmm. You, I think, have done that beautifully with this book. First of all, it's stunning. It's vibrant. The colors are just so sensorial, and it's, I must say, a collector's item.
appreciate that.
It's really, really stunning. And I want to talk about how you are bending the genre of cookbook, kind of in the same way that I saw Professor Morrison do it with The Black Book, right? And so in your introduction, you quote, say this, "I wanted people to be able to look at it like a coffee table book, or to go into their kitchens and to use it as a cookbook if they wanted to." And you also said, "Black food is meant to live alongside you, not only on coffee tables or credenzas or nightstands. Toss it in your bag, satchel, purse, or on the passenger seat and ride it out to your local farmer's market or grocery store. And literally, I actually follow your words. Last month, I was working for general election where I live, and I actually brought the book with me. And when we had some downtime, which one can imagine it was often, I pulled out the book and I started reading it. And my colleague, she said, "Oh, are you going to cook?" I said, "Well, no, not tonight. Tonight is going to be a long night. But I just got this copy of Black Food and it's remarkable." And so I said, you can look at it. And she was stunned at what was in the book. Particularly, she is from Africa. And in the section where you have the contributors talk about their particular food cultures, it was so great because it became a conversation starter. So she would elaborate on some of the ideas and the food ways in that particular country in Africa. And so I was just like, wow, this actually speaks to what Brian was actually getting to. It doesn't have to just live in the house, but you can travel with it. And it's just remarkable. And Bon Appetit actually, you know, said the same thing too. They said this, that I just want to read to you. The book, which brings together a chorus of voices across Black American diaspora, shapeshifts from recipes to art to essays. You'll find something new every time you open the book to a different page. It's almost hard to call it a cookbook because you'll be gaining more than a few recipes from it. So nice. To that point, tell me about how, you know, the desire to dispel or even bend the genre of a cookbook, because, you know, I think it's part cookbook, but also part exhibition book.
Yeah. Korsha Wilson, who wrote the profile of me, in the New York Times in advance of Black Food publication, said that the book in her eyes is more akin to an art exhibition. And I was like, yeah, you get it. But, yes. You know, when I think about the impact that Toni Morrison's book had on me, I mean, just like this book was put together in the 70s. And then I stumble across it as an undergrad in the late 90s. And I imagine that this book will have the same impact out 30 years from now. I want people to pick this book up and to just be equally moved and excited to delve into our histories. And I hope inspire people to bring things into the world that they think need to exist here. Was it Toni Morrison or Alice Waters who said, or Alice Walker? I feel like it was either Toni Morrison or Alice Walker or maybe it was Maya Angelou. It was Maya Angelou, I think, who talked about, like, you know, writing the book that you want to see in the world. One of those brilliant.
Oh, yes. That's giant. Professor Morrison.
That was Dr. Toni Morrison. Yeah.
Yep, okay. Yep, with the bluest eye.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, but I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we were so privileged to have Korsha Burke, who's a longtime editor at 10 Speed or Penguin Random House, work on this project. Korsha Burke was Maya Angelou's editor. She ushered the republication of Malcolm X's autobiography, Malcolm X. And she also ushered in like a reprinting of the Toni Morrison's Black Book. And, you know, I was very clear that with my publisher, 10 Speed Press, and I love them, and they've done an amazing job of supporting me, including giving me my own publishing imprint. But I was very clear that we needed Black eyes on this book. You know, my editor, Kelly Snowden, is a white woman, and I love working with her, and she's done right by me. But this book required a Black editor who could... And not just so, just to give you a little background in terms of like how this book came together, you know, even when we were thinking about just like art direction and visuals, you know, 10-speed press rarely works with like an outside art director, but I was very adamant that we needed not just a black art director, but a black art director who understands, you know, black visual language and aesthetics and, you know, understands black history and could connect with the work in a spiritual way. Right. And I think that, you know, George McCallman, our brilliant art director, he brought us a game and, you know, from the beautiful cover that you mentioned, to the design and just everything. I feel like this book, it sings visually because of his leadership. And so the thing about black food is that I've done in not as ambitiously, but you know, most of what I've done in here, I've done throughout my body of work. If you go back to Grub, my first book, we brought together these essays that talked about the problems in our industrialized food system. And, you know, we provided people with like nuts and bolts, tips and tools to make changes in their life, you know, as consumers and as community members and as citizens. And then we have the recipes that are, you know, kind of curated as menus. I commissioned this New York based artist, Tenjin Akita, to do these lentil cuts that represented each season because I divided the menus by season. And so this is just the first time that I've gotten a lot of money to do it so big and so well. So I just want to say that all my books, I've included like, you know, the playlist where, or suggested soundtracks with each recipe and, you know, suggested films and books and, you know, talked about these different histories and, you know, really looking at kind of like not just cooking, but also the process of cookbook making as collage and bringing together these different elements to create something that's, you know, new and exciting. So, you know, black food, we can't talk about the book without talking about my residency at the Museum of the African Diaspora. And, you know, that also largely shaped the direction of this book as well. I mean, I've been operating out of a fine art museum since 2015, and it was important for me to include, you know, that art be a through line in the book. You know, obviously the more than what 70 recipes are through line, but every chapter opens with a different visual piece that really encapsulates the energy and the content that, you know, follows. We have the playlists and the soundtracks. There's like, you know, essays, there's poetry there. You know, our prescriptions for taking care of ourselves in these kind of perilous times. So, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I think the beauty about this book is that everyone could find something in here. You know, I know that a lot of people, they just, for a number of reasons, don't cook a lot. And they'll see this as something that helps them learn more about the histories of Black food cultures. I know a lot of people who immediately started cooking from this. I was getting like photos and tagged and images on the day that the book was published. So I know that that's a draw for people. And then I hope that, you know, people find multiple uses. Maybe people who came for the book for the essays will eventually find their way into the kitchen, making the recipes. And, you know, I know people tell me all the time, this is like they keep it on their coffee table because when people come over, they want them to flip through it. And so I'm glad that it is showing up in these multiple ways in people's lives. And I hope that, you know, people can eventually consume it in its totality, or maybe not, you know, whatever. Once I'm done with it, then it does what it needs to do in the world. And I don't really have control over that.
One of the things that is different about this this cookbook compared to your previous ones is that it includes meat. So tell me about the decision to feature recipes that includes meat.
Sure. That was a tough decision, and it was largely like what was most kind of stressful about deciding to include animal products was feeling like I'd potentially let down many of my long time, you know, people have been following my work since 2009 or whatever. I had to take off my author's hat and put on my publisher hat and editor hat for this project and really decide what needed to happen in terms of being in service, the best service for this book project. And look, we put this book together in 9 months. This is literally a pandemic baby book.
Wow.
You know, we did things quickly. I felt a sense of urgency about getting this book into the world. And I pulled together a team quickly. We pulled together, you know, over 100 contributors throughout the Black diaspora really quickly. And so, you know, if we had more time, maybe I could have pulled off making this an all plant-based book. You know, I when I reached out to the different chefs to contribute recipes, I wasn't overly prescriptive, but I did, you know, at least encourage people to consider offering a plant-based dish. But one, some people, that's not their wheelhouse. And I wouldn't want someone to, you know, I didn't want it to be contrived. I didn't want someone to just like create some plant-based recipe for the sake of doing it in a book. And it didn't shine because that's not where, you know, their craft is like, they just don't specialize in that. But also, I just want to give people space to tell their stories about their connection with food in a way that was most authentic to them. You know, Hawa Hassan, the Somali American chef, she wanted to have this lamb stew, the Somali lamb stew, because it is a staple in her culture. And I think that story needs to be told. So I'm excited. I'm proud of the book. In terms of books by Bryant, you know, you can always buy my old books because this is my last, you know, in terms of me being an author, this is it for me. I'm retiring from book writing myself, but, you know, obviously as a publisher, I will be continuing to support others in making their own books.
So you said that you reached out to over 100 contributors. And one of the things that I noticed as I read the book was that you have separate contributors for essays and for recipes. There were very few that both contributed a recipe and an essay. How did you decide who was going to contribute to the book and what they were going to offer?
I mean, I have been thinking about a book project like this for a while. So just, you know, being in the community and doing this work and having all these brilliant colleagues to whom I was with whom I was connected, you know, I had a good sense of just people's expertise and what would make sense, you know, where people would best fit in a book project like this. I've been thinking about this book since I started my residency in MOAD because, you know, I'm co-creating this brilliant programming at this museum in San Francisco. And I've always felt from the beginning that this is something I wanted to share with the world. You know, this was 2015. We didn't really have an infrastructure for virtual programming. It was just kind of the ethos was, look, you come to the museum for the program and you're here that moment in time. And if you miss it, come to the next one. From the first program that I had as chef in residence, Black Women, Food and Power, you know, I was just blown away by the fact that we had people coming from all over the country. You know, I expected people from like Southern Cal or even coming from the Pacific Northwest. But the fact that we had people flying in from the East Coast for our 2-hour program at our small but mighty museum in San Francisco, I knew that this was special and that there was a hunger for this type of programming. And so just kind of put it on the back burner. But then, you know, in 2020 with the state murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and the subsequent uprisings and then the revelation of racism within food media, I knew that this was the time. This is when this book, we needed to bring this book into the world. And one of the first things I did was put together what I called my kitchen cabinet, where I tapped three of my brilliant friends and colleagues, Scott Alvis Barton, who's a chef and professor at the NYU Food Studies Program. Dara Cooper, who is like the ED of the National Food Justice Alliance and just a badass food justice activist. And then Therese Nelson, who is this New Jersey-based caterer and storyteller and community builder. So I let them know that I'm putting this book project together. And I know what I know. I know a lot of folks, but there's some folks that I don't know. And so I wanted them to help me really think about
who would best fit in each chapter. And, you know, I mean, everything. I just wanted to make sure I got this right. And I trusted, these colleagues, and I trusted their just kind of ensuring that we did this well. And I checked in with them about everything from structure to flow and pacing. But they were very instrumental in helping me really think through potential contributors and, you know, introducing me to folks that I might not know. Like, there are a number of people throughout the continent that I might have heard about their work or their research, but didn't know them personally. And so, you know, I really lean on community in putting this book together. And this is not my book. You know, my name's on the cover for obvious reasons, but I'm very clear that this book was a collective effort. I brought community together. I built a team. I'm good at what I'm good at. I'm good at building teams. I'm good at helping move people towards a goal. And we had just a brilliant collective of folks that helped birth this book into the world.
So one of the things that you just said was introducing you to people that you didn't know. With the book, I think that one of the names that people may not be familiar with is the legend, the pioneer in food media is Dr. Verdemay Smart Grosvenor. Can you tell our listeners a bit about her?
Oh, sure. Verdemay Smart Grosvenor is definitely an early influence on my work as a chef and as a creative person. I mean, she was a scholar. She's an anthropologist. She's a poet. She wrote about food. She was a media personality in terms of, like, you know, broadcast media. And she was one of the first people that I kind of encountered who helped me to understand, like, Gullah Geechee culture. I had heard about it, but, you know, her being so steeped in that culture and being kind of a ambassador to the Gullah Geechee culture of the coastal Carolinas, it just really helped me appreciate and understand that history much more. But, you know, I think one of the things about Verdemay Smart Grosvenor that inspired me early on, and in a similar way to Edna Lewis, was just her ability to kind of authentically allow all her interests to show up in a way that made sense. It kind of came together, you know, in terms of her being a public figure, you know, not just being limited to one thing. And I just, you know, I always say I'm a creative person. I don't like being reduced to anything. I mean, you know, a chef, an author or whatever, I'm a creative person. And I like thinking about multiple ways in which I can inspire people. And I think her work definitely did that for me. But, you know, one of the things is this whole idea of vibrational cooking is something that I've always thought about and encouraged people to just, you know, really understand the way in which we bring our energy to the food that we create. And when we feed people, they're, you know, absorbing that energy. I think about, you know, the novel and in the film, like Water for Chocolate, and how they kind of touched on that, you know, just the way in which we can transfer the energy we're holding into the food that we're making. And so I'd say just that whole concept and idea really helped me to think about cooking as a mindfulness practice and really understanding that, you know, in terms of mindfulness and meditation, we don't just have to be sitting on a mat inside some temple meditating. Like, we can take opportunities throughout our day to, you know, meditate, whether it's walking meditation, whether it's cooking as meditation. And that's one of the things that's been a through line of my work, is really just helping people to be more mindful and you know, embrace this idea that Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, talks about around interconnection and interbeing, and just the way in which there is no separation. We're all connected. Any living being, we're simply reflections of each other. And I think when we can hold that, it helps us to kind of move through the world differently, because, you know, even just something as simple as, like, the idea, and it's not simple, but, you know, just the idea of, like, sustainability. If I'm seeing myself being in unity and connection with every living being and system, then there's no way I'm going to pollute the air and the soil and the water, because, you know, I'm poisoning myself. So, you know, all that to say is Verdemay Smart Grosvenor has been a major inspiration for me in so many ways. And I'm glad that she's getting her due. In fact, I hope that this is still happening, but I know Julie Dash, the director, was working on a documentary film about Vladimir Mark Grosvenor, and I hope that is released to the world so that more people can know about her brilliance.
Oh, absolutely. I'll be eager for that to premiere.
Yep. She actually, and I don't know if you know, that she actually appeared in Julie Dash's film, Daughter of the Dust. So she's an actress as well. She just does everything.
Yes. She does. Yes. And I believe that she was on NPR. Like, she was a contributor for some years on NPR.
Yep.
Just fantastic. So one of the things that you just said was unity and connection. And I think one of the spaces where that happens for Black people is the cookout or the barbecue. And Adrian Miller wrote in his essay, The Barbecue, about the cookout. So talk to me about the importance of that particular site, or even just broadly speaking about the outdoors and gathering as a site for producing and cultivating Black food and community.
You know, Adrian Miller, our brilliant public scholar, the essay he wrote is actually one of my favorites. And I didn't know about this distinction between like barbecues and cookouts. And I'm actually more interested and excited about cookouts now that I know the distinction. And, you know, barbecues tended to be larger public spectacles. Typically they took a lot of preparation, which is done by, you know, in the antebellum period, enslaved Africans, preparing the space for white folks to then come and enjoy. And then, you know, afterwards during cleanup, and then, you know, Black folks were able to kind of eat food and just whatever, have that moment of respite. But, the idea of a cookout, the difference, as Adrian Miller describes in this essay, between a cookout and a barbecue, cookouts are, one, typically spontaneous. They are something that, you know, is usually planned weeks in advance. They tend to be more intimate, a smaller gathering. The host might make an anchor dish, but they have more of a potluck feel in terms of the expectation that everyone brings something to the table. And people are just hanging out. And I just feel like in this period of, you know, this pandemic and shelter in place, that has been just our stilo, you know, in terms of al fresco cooking outdoors and al fresco dining, and then just having these very intimate gatherings where we can build community and connect in a moment where that's been, you know, so lacking in our lives. So, yeah, I'm all about the cookout, and I encourage people, when you pick up the book, go straight for that essay, because it's meaty.
No pun intended. There's a chapter in the book called Land Liberation and Food Justice. And when I think about food justice, I think about those first two, land and liberation, that's integral to this call to action. Given your work in this area of food justice, Black food justice, what does food justice looks to you?
Well, I'll tell you what food justice looks like to me in the future and what it's always looked like to me. And, you know, when I think about the way in which many of these snow-capped NGOs come into communities on a range of issues, but just talking about food, there is often this relationship with the community that's very exploitative, that truly isn't, you know, addressing the real structural barriers, the economic, the physical, the geographic barriers that so many communities face to accessing healthy, affordable food. I mean, like, quite frankly, so many of these organizations are reproducing the same harm that we've seen in this not-for-profit industrial complex, where people, they aren't really addressing the problems. You know, it reminds me of the kind of emergence of the field of social work in the early 20th century. Danny Walkowicz, this professor at NYU in the Metropolitan Studies program, has this book, Working with Class. And he talks about just, you know, the way in which this field, you know, in its early period, is you have these privileged white women going into communities, you know, Black communities, Native communities, or even, you know, we think about the way in which, you know, many Europeans weren't even considered white at that point, going into like the you know, Italian and Jewish and Irish communities. Like, it was really about, it wasn't so much about helping people or lifting folks out of poverty. It was about kind of patrolling the boundaries of class and policing the behavior of poor people. And I see this similar kind of harm reproduced in the food justice movement, and, or I should say the food movement, because food justice, I would argue, the cornerstone. So I'll say it like this. Food justice moves beyond advocacy and direct service and calls for organized responses to food insecurity or food apartheid, as we're describing it, responses that are owned and driven by those most impacted by these issues. And I think that's what has to happen. That's how we'll see communities being liberated, because people in communities, they're aware of the issues. They're aware of the problems that they face, whether it be environmental racism or food apartheid or, you know, crumbling infrastructure or underfunded, segregated public schools. People are aware of what's happening in communities. What they need are power and resources shifted into their hands so that people can be self-determined and actually move towards liberation in the way that they best see fit. So that's what food justice is for me.
I like that. So we're in the holiday season, Bryant, and what is one dish that you would make, you know, to celebrate the holidays? Or what is one dish that you would tell our listeners to try out for this holiday season?
I will say, get Black food, go straight to page 296 and make this blueberry cheesecake by Malcolm Livingston II, this brilliant brother from the Bronx who was a part of the Ghetto Gastro Collaborative or Collective. And he worked at Noma, which many people, you know, say is the best restaurant in the world, Noma in Copenhagen. And this cheesecake, this vegan blueberry cheesecake, is mind blowing. And I'll say that, you know, oftentimes people have a lot of hangups or kind of negative perceptions of what vegan cooking is. And I find that oftentimes a great way to ease people in is by, you know, giving them a really tasty vegan dessert. And I think that if you have some folks who doubt that they can be satisfied and pleased with vegan food, make them that blueberry cheesecake, and yeah, it'll be a different conversation after that.
So we have our marching orders to make the blueberry cheesecake, y'all. Yeah. So, Bryant, last question. Tell me what you are working on now.
I'm working on my publishing company. As I mentioned, my literary agent and I, we proposed me having my own publishing imprint, the Penguin Random House, and we got it. Four Color Books is the name of the imprint. Four beautiful illustrated books for BIPOC folks, for drawing outside the lines. And I, you know, always my little wink at Black folks, Black women is 4C, you know, in terms of like hair texture. You know, for Color is, we are, I mean, we hit the ground running. We've acquired four books already. We're on the cusp of acquiring a couple more. You know, we'll start off in terms of building our foundation with cookbooks and food related books. That's my wheelhouse. But, you know, as the company grows and as our list unfolds, I want to publish books on everything I'm interested in, from poetry to prescriptive nonfiction to self-help and personal development. In fact, the second book we acquired was a lifestyle book by this young brother, Adrian Burriel, who's this Brooklyn-based photographer, and he's doing this project where he's traveling to educational institutions across the country and documenting Black student life from Ivy League to trade schools. And this came out of a project he did while he was an undergrad at UT Austin. I think it was the 1.9 project, which was kind of reflecting on the population of Black men at UT Austin, 1.9%. And he did, you know, these portraits of, you know, Black students on campus and lifestyle photos, and coupled them with their words about being Black on this PWI in the 21st century. And then he got, like, you know, some art exhibitions that he was able to, you know, do to celebrate the work. And we bought his book. So all that to say is I'm very excited about the projects that we'll be gifting the world. And I think if you know me and you know my approach, my ethos, my body of work, you can expect similar projects in terms of, like, the energy that I brought to the publishing world. So super excited about that. And not just excited about publishing books. You know, there's a whole action arm of For Color where we're really, you know, putting a lot of energy into helping to ensure that BIPOC folks have more opportunities in food media and publishing. So we're planning a Black Food Summit at MOAD for April of 2022. We are amassing databases with Black and BIPOC art directors and food photographers and prop stylists and food stylists and, you know, all these different fields in food media that are hard to get into because it's about, you know, networks and shadowing on set and being mentored. So, you know, For Color is invested in helping to do all we can to ensure that we have a more diverse food media and publishing world.
That's amazing to open the door for the next generation of food writers, cooks, chefs, and poets and writers. So I really look forward to how your life will evolve as you go down this new path as a publisher.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Brian Terry is a James Beard and an NAACP Image Award-winning chef, educator, and author. He's the editor and curator of his newest book, Black Food: Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora, published by Four Color Books. Brian, thank you so much for being on the show. I really, really enjoyed this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.